Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, with the recent 79th anniversaries of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombings on August 6th and August 9th, now is a good time to take another look at the state of nuclear warfare today. Is it legal? It's a complex subject, and we won't have all the answers today, but my guest is the perfect expert to discuss the issues. Litigator, arbitrator, mediator, and law professor Charles J. Moxley Jr. is author of, are you ready? Nuclear Weapons and International Law, Existential Risks of Nuclear War and Deterrence Through a Legal Lens, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Charles J. Moxley Jr., go to nuclearweaponslaw.org. And Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ira. So good to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
It's a pleasure. This will be a great discussion. I want to start out with Chapter 18. Not that you're going to remember everything about every
chapter. Chapter 18. I've got the table of contents here, but I think I know what it is.
You reference beyond theory is practice. And you talk about the times when the U.S. threatened nuclear war. And so I'm sure we're not the only country that did so. And I reference, of course, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. What brought you to write this book and attempt to explain why it's illegal when there's clearly other countries that have it? And even if I'm going to play devil's advocate, if we were to outlaw it, that doesn't stop other nations, including rogue nations, continuing to develop and use nuclear weapons.
I've seen some of your podcasts, Ira, and you always start with the tough and the broad, you know, but this is a huge field, right? And there's obviously thousands of nuclear weapons and a number of countries have them and all of that. But I think the interesting thing to focus on is what are the risks of these things? Because it is sort of, I think, receded from our consciousness since the end of the Cold War. What are the risks? And then look at it as a matter of policy and security policy. Do they make sense? And yes, law. There is a role for law here.
There is a role. And I'm glad you bring that up because I agree. There is an area where law obviously has an impact. But I go back to my original question or part of it, which is, how do you apply law to lawless countries?
You know, it's a hard question.
That's why I asked it, of course.
But I think the answer in part is that international law, and the particular area here, obviously, is the law of armed conflict, right? And there is a robust body of law around that topic. No country follows it assiduously. We have followed it at times and at times not followed it. But I think, in a sense, the broadest answer to it is that it's in everybody's sense. It's in everybody's interest. Combatants on both sides have an interest in protection of their own soldiers when they're captured, protection of their own soldiers from excessive force. Broadly, there's an interest in protection of civilians. So in a broad sense, there's a mutual interest. I think in this nuclear area, which I'm sure we'll be talking about today,
right?
The self-interest is even bigger. I mean, I think the answer is in the self-interest, and it would be interesting to talk about that right. A little.
Well, that goes back to a doctrine that goes back decades, which is MAD, mutual assured destruction. And that assumes rational players in the international arena. Now, you may have certain countries, excuse my voice going out in the middle of this, but you may have certain countries which have a certain complex and as a result don't think rationally all the time. And hence, how are they deterred under that concept? And is that still valid, MAD?
Yeah. I think these questions that you raise, which are very broad, can be looked at from different perspectives. One is, we have terrible crime in our country domestically and in other areas of the world. There's crime, but we don't drop penal laws. We try to enforce it. We try to get parties to comply. As to our nuclear weapons policies, MAD and deterrence, MAD is part of deterrence, right? Nuclear deterrence is if the other guy hits us, we'll respond. Or if they look like they're going to hit us, we may respond. And MAD is the notion, mutual assured destruction. Don't you dare attack us, because what will we do? We'll come back with such a massive thing that we'll destroy everything that you care about, and we'll destroy you. And is that still with us? Ira, it is at the center. It's the biggest piece of it. There's kind of a subtopic, if you want to talk about it, I think it would make
sense. No.
Which is the area of low-yield nuclear weapons, okay? Because
Nuclear weapons?
Yeah, tactical nuclear weapons, instead of being, you know, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki weapons were at the level of 17 to 20 kilotons. Which by today's inventories of these weapons is low. I mean, our typical nuclear weapon is 300 or 400 kilotons. I mean, much bigger. And there are even weapons, we don't have them now, as I understand it, in the megatons. But there are low-yield nuclear weapons. There are nuclear weapons that are less than a kiloton. And there are some that are 3, 4. And so the defenders of these weapons, and this goes to your basic question, how do you have any regulation here? And how do you have any rule? And what do you do with people who aren't following the rules? The defenders of nuclear weapons say, don't listen to people who say, oh, it threatens human survival, because we'll end up using high yield nuclear weapons with hundreds of kilotons. We can use low yield, and we can use them for deterrence. And, you know, if for people who might be interested in getting involved in this area, reading in it, trying to, you know, come to grips with it and maybe try to affect the policymakers on the policies we have here. This is the area, you know, you talk about the hole in the bagel and the things that make sense and the absurdities.
Right.
This is the core of the irrationality of our defense policies, because our justification is we'll use low-yield nuclear weapons and not the high-yield, and they're not indiscriminate and they're not disproportionate and they can comply with legal standards, and the other side will, you know, take heed, and maybe they'll use low yield too, but that's all that'll happen. But the problem, and this is something you and I were talking about earlier before we started this discussion, the problem is the people who are on the inside who talk about this, once they leave office, and I have a chapter in my book on this, talk about how this notion of using low yield doesn't make any sense. I mean, it is an emperor has no clothes phenomenon, I'm afraid, because the likelihood of escalation is very, very high. Now, can you say, you know, there will be escalation or there won't? I mean, obviously one can't know depending on the particular facts. But by all accounts, from everybody in the civilian and the military leadership and the policy people who have looked at this, it doesn't seem questionable that there is a high risk of escalation with the low yield. So in a sense, the ultimate answer, Ira, I think, to your question, what do you do with all the, you know, the countries that don't care and don't respect rights? And, you know, and that's assuming we do, you know, but the countries that won't comply. The answer, if there is one, I believe, is self-interest and survival.
But I go back to my point, which is if you have someone who is a extreme leader, not a rational thought person, or you have a group of people leading a country that's messianic, for example, and don't see it the world the way everybody else sees it, how do you account for that? How do you adjust for that? How do you even get them to agree to not use these weapons or to get rid of them?
That is a core issue.
I'm only here to bring up core issues to Charlie. Your thesis.
There we go. That's a question that comes up, for instance, with a terrorist, right? And so the assumption is you can't defer a terrorist, right? Because a terrorist wants to die, is willing to wear the bombs on their body.
Yeah, the suicide vest. Yeah.
Right. But the premise, and it may not always be true, but, you know, and there obviously are people who are irrational or very prone to heavy levels of risk taking who get into authority, even in major countries. Right. So it's not as if this is a perfect answer, but most leaders, most countries, at a minimum, have a self-interest in their own survival, their family, their regime. That's the
agreed. Agreed that I'm not just even disputing that or denying that. You're absolutely correct. Which is the genesis for MAD again, because everybody is realizing if we use these weapons, we're going to mutually destroy each other. So I get that thesis. I'm just concerned about if you get 90% of people agreeing with you on that, but the 10% don't, what do you do about that 10%? Again, through a legal lens as part of your title of your book, which is a long one, but I like it. It's Nuclear Weapons and International Law, Existential Risks of Nuclear War and Deterrence Through a Legal Lens. So how do you enforce legality to a regime or a group of people who are that 10% that I just referenced?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I do meetings and webinars with the military. It's one of the things I've tried to do with my book. As you know, I'm a professor, an adjunct professor at Fordham, and I've run a lot of programs that are available, have been published by law journals and the like, with the leadership, you know, on the military side of our country, right? And that's what one hears. The other guys are bad guys. The other guys are crazy. And, you know, I mean, and I'm sure others say that about us, right?
But the point is, you're not answering my question, which is, what do you do with that 10% of people who, I'm going to use another term too, and separate from crazy, move crazy to the side, move fanatic to the side. How about just the word evil? You have some evil person that if he or she can't get her way in leading her his or her country, that he's going to, and her or one of them is going to go and go ahead and start shooting off nuclear weapons that they may have in their arsenal. How do you account for that through a legal lens? I guess that's the bottom line on it all.
Right. I think that if you have an extreme crazy or a leadership that is out of control and concerned about its own survival, you have a risk of a situation which we can't affect, right? And so that will happen at times. I mean, I think, for instance, right now, it would be unrealistic to say that, oh, our president, whoever it is going to call up Vladimir Putin and they're going to work something out. I mean, our representatives, our diplomats, the people at the UN, from what I hear, you know, we're not even talking. So we have to be realistic here. And there's no pretending that, oh, you know, it's going to be easy. But the bottom line is self-interest and mutual security. That's what was found during the Cold War. It was in both sides' interest because the risks weren't so great. And the regimes, while fanatic, the leaderships weren't crazy. That they were, you know, and we were fortunate there. I mean, you look at Khrushchev and JFK and Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis. You could have had different leadership, and what you're talking about could have gotten under control. You know, it could have gotten out of control. And when one, you know, reads about the Cuban Missile Crisis and some of the advice that Kennedy was getting from the military and the like, and we were talking about McNamara earlier, you know, some of the advice they were getting was very aggressive and would have had a high likelihood, it seemed, to have precipitated, you know, much worse events. But Kennedy and Khrushchev, and there are all those stories about how that played out, but they managed to come somewhat indirectly through an accommodation, and rationality prevailed.
Right, at the last minute,
right. Yeah, but right. I think I take your point that what I'm talking about is hard, and some would say it's impossible because there's always going to be the evil. But I am more optimistic that if we can think about it and harness the potential for survival, if nothing else, I'm not talking altruism, right, but self-interest and survival.
No, understood totally. Yeah. A quick credit to Donald Brennan, who came up with the term of mutual assured destruction. And he was working, I think, at the Herman Kahn Hudson Institute at the time. I may be wrong, but maybe I'm right. You can correct me, Professor, if I'm right or wrong, because you know this stuff up and down.
I don't know if he came up with the term. But
okay, I think he did. But okay, well, we'll leave it in. I'll assume I'm correct. If I'm not, we'll hear from listeners.
Yeah. But it's been a pervasive one.
Right. I want to delve more into your book, but one last point to this thread of the discussion. And that is, you know, we also talk about biological warfare and chemical warfare, and how same theoretically that MAD concept would apply. And yet in certain countries, and frankly, between some countries, gas and chemical warfare were used. I mean, you go back even World War I, some degree World War II, but even more recently in terms of certain countries internally using chemical weapons or gas against their own population. So how is it? Are you still comfortable with that framework given the history of these other weapons?
Yes. And I think, Ira, that I didn't get to the legal piece of your earlier question. And I think this is part of it.
Okay.
Where is the law? The law on chemical and biological weapons is easier to state than it is with nuclear. And if I may, let me just take 2 minutes and
absolutely. Yep.
Frame it.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah. We have international treaties, multinational conventions that are signed by many countries of the world, including the United States, banning chemical and biological weapons. I mean, we have treaties on that. And is it perfect? And have we totally gotten rid of these weapons? And has there been perfect compliance? No. But there's a regime. I mean, remember what Ronald Reagan said? He had that phrase that he had picked up the Russian thing, you know, that you trust but verify.
Right.
And so part of the answer to your question is a combination of what I was saying. You have to wait till there is a time when people can talk. That happened after the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was an awareness, and then America and the Soviet Union did all kinds of treaties, as you know. I mean, we were talking earlier about the Cold War. We had all these arms control treaties and all these hotlines and communication things. So that's what you want to put in place. And then you have the most basic concept of security. Is security hegemony, you know, being stronger and more powerful? Or in a nuclear world, is it mutual security? So that is still on the policy piece. On the legal piece, with nuclear weapons, we don't have something comparable to the Biological and Chemical Weapons Conventions. We have the TPNW, the Treaty for the Prevention of Nuclear War, entered into some years ago, but the nuclear weapons countries haven't signed on to that and they haven't joined it. So that's of interest, but not central in my way of looking at it. The central thing is that there is this body of recognized law of armed conflict. The U.S. recognizes it, Russia recognizes it, China, we all recognize it. And, you know, that is an approach towards compliance, right? Because we have these rules and we have to start applying them. But here's, in a way, if I have a point that I would hope would be the take home for people who might listen to your podcast here, and I know you have a lot of followers. If I had a point, it would be that, you know, we have to change what's happened to us as to nuclear weapons. I think they've become, since the Cold War, the younger generation doesn't have the concern that those of us of that earlier generation, you know, we grew up where there was the threat of it and the daily threat, and it was a concern. My students at Fordham Law School, you know, young folks who are smart and educated and brilliant backgrounds and brilliant futures, they don't have the awareness that we had, even though they're young and idealistic, so many of them, you know. We need to change our mindset. We have been lulled, I think, by this notion of deterrence, that, oh, we have a policy of deterrence and we can stop the bad guys because they know we'll come back with mutual, you know, we'll destroy them if they, and so that is a, what's that phrase that we hear? That's the Faustian bargain that we make. We'll have this threat of mutual assured destruction, of deterrence. We'll make that threat, and then we're safe, and we don't have to worry. And the problem is that that policy isn't just a bunch of words. It's backed up by a readiness. You mentioned looking at chapter 18. There's also 21 where there's a table in there with the world's nuclear weapons. You know, so there's all these weapons here. All these countries have a policy of deterrence. So there's a readiness, and this readiness imposes huge risks that in moments of volatility, moments of fog of war, that through no, you know, genuine intent of anybody, no overt intent, we'll find ourselves using these things. And so that's what we need. We need to change and think about the risks. And, you know, and I'm going to stop. I mean, I'm going on and on too much here, but
no, you're fine. You're fine.
There have been some great studies. There's a guy, Alan Robach at Rutgers. You ought to have him on one of these podcasts. Wonderful man who is a scientist who studied the effects of these weapons. And he, with about 12 other authors from around the world, really, did the most recent of these studies. I think it was August of 2022. About what would the effects of a nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia be, you know? And the premise was, it built on what I said earlier, that, you know, you wouldn't just have a low yield thing. If you cross that nuclear taboo, right, and you actually use these weapons between nuclear powers like U.S. and Russia, you'd be in a nuclear war. And the study that they did, which was real science by people, you know, who really know this stuff and spent a lot of time on it and modeled all this, that a nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia would cause, what do you think? I mean, how many deaths do you think it might cause?
I would say in the hundreds of millions.
5 billion. 5 billion. Because what happens is, once you have these exchanges, you have the nuclear winter thing, which is that when the weapons, you know, explode near the ground, they throw up all this dust and debris and smoke, and it blocks out the sun, and it destroys the growing season in huge areas of the globe, and people die of starvation. So, I mean, I actually went and Googled when I read that number some years ago, what's the population and projected of the globe? And, you know, this 5 billion number, I think, was their number. It was close to the population. What the population of the globe was, 7 billion, or I don't remember the exact number. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it would, you know, the threat, if we could face the reality of the threat, is of that order of magnitude of destruction of civilization and, in a sense, human life as we know it. I mean, it's not hyperbole. If one accepts the premise, which unfortunately seems valid, that you'd have escalation from a low yield use, and that is, if it's between nuclear countries, there's so much that's semi-automatic. I mean, our policies are misguided. When Biden was coming in, there he had advisors, and it was in the media for people who follow this, that, well, maybe we would change our triad. And we wouldn't have, you know, the triad is, you know, we have the land-based, the sea-based, and the air-based. The sea-based are submarines. So we have something like 400 land-based ICBMs. They're sitting duck, vulnerable, you know, not protected, not in hardened, deeply buried sites. So if our intelligence system says there's a nuclear strike coming in, we have like 40 minutes. Well, it's actually 20 minutes, the Joint Chiefs tell us now, for the president, for the word to go up to the president and the president to decide there's nuclear strike coming in, they're going to destroy our ICBMs. So if we want to be able to use them, we have to use them. So the impetus towards use, the level of genuine risk is higher, I think, than even our policymakers, you know, reflect on.
We have a couple of minutes left. What's the main point you want readers to take from the book, especially the part about the legal lens? So clearly it's from the legal framework that you're addressing this issue.
Thank you so much. All right. The interesting thing on the legal piece, I mentioned law of armed conflict, is there are principles there. There's five of them that are really essential. You know, you can only use the level of force as is necessary. You can't use an indiscriminate weapon that cannot distinguish between a legitimate combatant target and a civilian or other protected target. You can't do it. It's clearly unlawful. Every country recognizes its unlawfulness. And then proportionality. You can't have disproportionate effects on civilians. So these are fundamental rules. And there's another one, which is precaution. You have to prepare your weapons and your people and your training and your policy so you're able to comply with law. These are not controversial. And if we had somebody from the military in and said, okay, you know, do you guys agree with what Charlie Moxley is saying the rules are here? We would disagree a little on how to apply them or what they mean, but not on what the rules are or, you know, basically what they say. So I think the take home is twofold. One, we need to, you know, get rid of our cognitive dissonance where it's sort of like that book, Denial of Death. We all know we're going to die, but we deny it. And we're, you know, we have a denial of nuclear deterrence and mutual assured destruction, MAD, as to their riskiness. So I think we have to realize their riskiness and then be guided by a sense of survival towards use of whatever we can, use of survival, self-interest of other people, and some interest in law. I think law has a role here. And I think the challenge for you and for me and for your many listeners on these podcasts is to reflect on the risks and talk with our policy leaders when we have an opportunity and say, hey, you got to go back and look at this. We need to get something more rational here, more in our interest of survival, ourselves, our families, our way of life, and really, you know, everything we believe in.
Well, before I let you go in 30 seconds, after finishing the book, are you relatively optimistic or relatively pessimistic?
It's hard to be greatly optimistic for the reasons you gave, but I'm determined. I've written the book, and now I'm very grateful for chances to have discussions like this. And I hope we can begin to have an impact. I think if we can get people to think about these risks, self-interest, intelligence, and some level of human goodness, will kick in. And I'm optimistic we can make progress, but it won't happen without a real effort by all of us.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been litigator, arbitrator, mediator, and law professor Charles J. Moxley Jr. He's author of Nuclear Weapons and International Law, Existential Risks of Nuclear War and Deterrence Through a Legal Lens. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Charles J. Moxley, go to nuclearweaponslaw.org. And Charles, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Ira. I really enjoyed this discussion.
So did I. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.